This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The latest incident of violence in Juba has been just another indication of all of the reasons why we've been calling for an arms embargo since the start of the conflict.
That's Elizabeth Deng, South Sudan researcher for Amnesty International, reacting to the recent heavy fighting in Juba. Also, the former Burundi Minister of East African Community Affairs was killed by unknown gunmen outside her home in Burundi's capital. Humanitarian workers have discovered acute malnutrition and famine-like conditions in 15 camps for displaced people in northern Nigeria. And Greek police arrest 29 people, including a police officer, and two alleged human smuggling rings. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, a ceasefire that went into effect Monday night in South Sudan appears to be holding today. The ceasefire ended 5 days of fighting in Juba between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and those supporting First Vice President Riek Machar. Hundreds of people were reported killed and tens of thousands displaced. Some who made it across the border into Uganda say they were attacked and robbed by unknown gunmen in South Sudan. Meanwhile, the latest fighting has caused the rights group Amnesty International to renew its call for a ceasefire. Elizabeth Deng is the group's South Sudan researcher. From Nairobi, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
The latest incident of violence in Juba has been just another indication of all of the reasons why we've been calling for an arms embargo since the start of the conflict. And that's because the warring parties are seemingly incapable of using force in a manner that's consistent with international humanitarian law, particularly the requirements under humanitarian law to protect civilians, to take measures to avoid incidental loss of civilian lives, to refrain from targeting civilians, to refrain from targeting UN personnel and places of refuge, such as the UN Protection of Civilian Sites. So we are calling on the Security Council to proceed with imposing a comprehensive arms embargo in South Sudan.
Explain how the embargo would work.
A comprehensive arms embargo would require every state to take measures to prevent the direct or indirect supply, sale, or transfer of arms to South Sudan. So basically, the objective would be to cut off any types of support to the country, either to the government or to opposition forces.
What about sanctions? Why wouldn't they be enough, in your view?
Well, we are also calling for targeted sanctions against individuals believed to have committed human rights violations. The Security Council has already provided a framework for the imposition of targeted sanctions, and it should proceed with imposing those, you know, including travel bans and asset freezes. We think that, especially in the context where there has been no criminal accountability for human rights and humanitarian law violations, these sanctions could be an important deterrent to people who seemingly commit abuses with a sense of impunity.
Now, this week, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon spoke about the problems in South Sudan, and he specifically mentioned investigations into possible war crimes, crimes against humanity. What's your reaction?
Right. Well, there has been impunity in South Sudan. The UNMISS mission has a mandate to investigate and document human rights violations and is supposed to report regularly. It does have a large team of human rights monitors, but unfortunately their reporting is not, you know, as regular or timely as we would hope. The peace agreement signed last August also provided for a hybrid court for South Sudan, which would, of course, have an investigative body. We have been calling for the speedy establishment of the court by the African Union Commission and for priority to be given to the operationalization of the investigative branch. And although some human rights investigations have taken place, these are actually different from criminal investigations whose objective is to identify those responsible and bring them to justice before a tribunal.
Elizabeth Deng is the South Sudan researcher from Amnesty International. From Nairobi, she spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua. While the fighting in Juba displaced about 36,000 people and triggered a shortage of food and water across the city, markets were forced to close during the violence. With a ceasefire in effect, more Juba residents are returning to the streets and markets are beginning to reopen. But residents say the recent fighting created a shortage of basic necessities. Dikmala Mala is Mercy Corps' South Sudan country director. She tells reporter Ian Bure that her team is working to deliver food and water to people in need.
Relatively, it's looking better. And some shops, very few, some shops have been open. Unfortunately, there is not much left for many shops in some parts of the city to open because they have been looted. But we are now seeing lesser checkpoints. Of course, military deployment is still there, but civilian movement is there. Shops opened today around 10 a.m., but they were closed around 2 o'clock. Apparently, the shopkeepers do not have enough confidence to keep the shops open.
Has your team experienced any restrictions in their movement as they are trying to assist people in South Sudan?
So in this situation, obviously, when there's so much of risk of movement in the city, we cannot access any community. But it has been slightly better in terms of movement and access yesterday and today. However, not everybody, or let me say most people, are still feeling a bit uncertain. The confidence still needs to be built up that this ceasefire is going to hold and the parties committed to the ceasefire will continue with their commitment, and the level of support and attention which we have got from the international community in the recent days, let's say, it will sustain.
Now, other than water, are there any other shortages of basic necessities that last week's conflict has created?
So drinking water, food, and remember, in Juba, it is rainy season, so we are also concerned about sanitation and hygiene services as well, because there are large numbers of people congregated at smaller locations, making it very crowded. So according to us, as of now, the acute needs are drinking water, food, water, sanitation, and hygiene.
That was Dikmala Mala, South Sudan country director for the humanitarian organization Mercy Corps. She spoke with reporter Ayen Bure. The UN says humanitarian workers have discovered acute malnutrition and famine-like conditions in 15 camps for displaced people in northern Nigeria. The Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, reports more than 275,000 people are suffering severe food shortages in remote camps. Those camps are located in Borno State, one of three states devastated by attacks over the last 7 years by Boko Haram militants. More than 2 million have been displaced in three Nigerian states, and nearly 2 million others are displaced in the Lake Chad Basin. The coordinated military offensive by Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon, and Mali has dealt a major blow to the militant group Boko Haram. But while militant factions may be scattered, an analyst warns they are likely to continue to threaten northwest Nigeria and the region for years to come. Ohio University Associate Professor Brandon Kendhammer is an expert on the insurgency. He says Boko Haram has always been able to adapt to new circumstances. He spoke with VOA's David Arnold about the reduced status of the insurgency.
The U.S. counterterrorism report for 2015 that just came out suggests Boko Haram's capacity to hold territory has been significantly degraded over the last 12 months, and they attribute that mostly to improved regional cooperation with the multinational joint task force, particularly since President Buhari took office a little over a year ago. And they suggest that we're unlikely to see Boko Haram being able to mount same sorts of big military operations that they were doing in the run-up to the 2015 elections. We've heard that before about Boko Haram, and so were things to change on the ground, it seems plausible that we could see a major reversal. But for now, it does seem pretty clear that Boko Haram is not able to do the same kinds of large-scale military operations, sort of pitched battles with the Nigerian military or with these multinational forces that it had been engaging in previously.
Even the reports of suicide bombings seem to have dropped significantly in recent weeks.
Certainly, I think that there have been less reports, but the efforts of Boko Haram seem to be split at this. There was the attack last month across the Niger border. There have also been a series of attacks, at least the Cameroonian government is saying, on border outposts in Cameroon, suicide bombing at a mosque in Cameroon. And that's a pretty big geographic area to be switching back and forth from. And so it's hard to know if perhaps there's some sort of planning or bigger attacks are in store, or if they really have been degraded. I think if you look at Boko Haram's history since 2009, one of the things that sticks out about them is that they've always been very good at reacting and responding to changes in their situation.
Are there elements of Boko Haram still in that forest?
We've heard, yes, there have been this ramp up of Nigerian airstrikes. They're calling it Operation Gamma Aiki, which translates Operation Finish the Work. Some of those attacks have been targeted in that area. Others have been further afield. The area that you see on a Google Images search for Sambisa Forest is not quite as large as that sort of area actually is. And so people are moving sort of out of that area into mountains along the Cameroon border. It seems like the area that Boko Haram is occupying is no longer contiguous. There's that kind of one cluster near the Cameroonian border, the southern end of Borno, the top end of Adamawa. Then there seems to be kind of this other area near the Niger border. It is striking in Niger, but also in Cameroon simultaneously. It's trying to make it hard for a state military response to find one area and engage in a final battle. I think Boko Haram has been very crafty. And so my not very optimistic assessment is that we're likely to see at least some form of this conflict around for quite a long time. Whether it's because they're getting outside support or because they've been very good at taking advantage of the resources that have been available on the ground, the Nigerian military has been recovering solar panels that Boko Haram has been using to charge its electronics. They're a group that really takes advantage of the resources that are available locally to maintain the insurgency.
Do they have outside support?
The U.S. government, for one, is very divided on this. The incoming commanding general of AFRICOM recently, you know, so strongly said, yes, the ISIS link with Boko Haram is important and is affecting operations. The quotes coming out of the State Department that have suggested, no, we think that it's more symbolic. What I see is the fact that when Boko Haram changes tactics locally, it typically does so in response to something that's changed locally, rather than some declaration that's coming from al-Baghdadi.
I would assume the Nigerian military is fairly pleased with what has been accomplished recently.
You know, I'm not a great optimist when it comes to claims like that, because it's been a long conflict. You know, as recently as 16 or 17 months ago, you would have the Nigerian defense spokesman, you know, basically accusing the Nigerian army of, you know, being allied with Boko Haram on Twitter. And now, you know, there is this kind of spirit of cooperation. There is this deference to the need to have a regional strategy. I would like to imagine that a Nigeria that's resolved some of these ongoing insurgency problems would pivot towards thinking about how do we engage in a more constructive internal policing system? How do we find a more constructive role for the military in security policy, both internally and externally, that doesn't require some of the sort of local occupations that basically we've had under the insurgencies? There's been a lot of talk about what's going to happen to the civilian joint task force, the group of civilian vigilantes that have been very important in the fight against Boko Haram in places like Maiduguri. I'm not sure that the military or the security structure in Nigeria has a clear plan for what they're going to do with all these people who've been mobilized. The areas that Boko Haram has left in the last few months have not necessarily been filled in by a robust return of state resources and governance, and that means that these areas are still vulnerable, even if Boko Haram can't attack them right now or can't hold them right now. And that's a problem going forward.
That's Ohio University Associate Professor Brandon Kenthammer. From Athens, Ohio, he spoke with VOA's David Arnold. Coming up on 20 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Well, former Burundi Minister of East African Community Affairs, Hafsa Mosi, was killed today by unknown gunmen outside her home in Burundi's capital. Moses Havayarimana reports.
Mosi was a former BBC journalist who became the first Burundi Minister of East African Community. Burundi authorities say an investigation has been launched into the killing. Pierre Nkurikiye is the police spokesman.
So he has been killed when he was leaving his home. No one is arrested until now. And when they tried to rescue the woman to the military hospital, she arrived there already died. So now police investigation is still going on.
Mosi was a ruling party member who was the chairperson of the East African Legislative Assembly Burundi chapter. She was influential in regional diplomatic relations and East African community integration since the country joined the region's economic bloc in 2007. Nadine Muhimbari is Moses' sister.
Watu kwa roho mbaya anamtoa binadamu mwenzake ni masikitiko makubwa kwa sababu kwani ameacha alikuwa mama wa familia.
She says people with a killing attitude decided to kill her. She says she was a mother and the head of the family. Yes, they had killed her, but they will also die one day. She said that she was shocked when she heard the news and had rushed to the hospital, only to find that she was already dead because she was shot in the neck. East African Legislative Assembly Speaker Daniel Kidega condemned the assassination and called on the government to apprehend the assailants. There have been many targeted killings by unknown groups in Burundi since the crisis began last year, with most government officials being victims of the attacks. Mosi's sister called on the Burundians to unite and stop bloodshed that has left more than 500 people dead.
Burundi kikubwa tu watu tu maslahi, yani yote ni maslahi ya watu. Unapikilia maslahi yako.
This is all because of the self-interest by some individuals. She says all Burundians should get together to work in harmony to end the current crisis. Amnesty International Regional Director of the East and Horn and the Great Lakes, Mutoni Wanyeki, says Hafsa Mosi's death is the latest in the disturbing string of profile killings and called on an independent and impartial investigation to be carried out. Meanwhile, the peace dialogue in Arusha that started yesterday is in mayhem after government representative walked out of the meeting. They say they will not negotiate with some opposition leaders who the government accuses of plotting the failed coup last year. The crisis began in April of last year when the president Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek for a third term in the office. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
In Zimbabwe, the state prosecutor has charged a Pentecostal pastor with attempting to overthrow the government and inciting public violence. The government says Reverend Evan Mawawiri has used an internet video campaign called This Flag to encourage protest against President Robert Mugabe. Last Wednesday, the capital and several other cities shut down in protest over deteriorating social conditions, including the failure of the government to pay salaries. Protests were also called for today and tomorrow. Reporter Peter Thornycroft is monitoring the situation. VOA's William Eagle asked her for the latest on Reverend Mawawiri's court appearance.
It was delayed for a long time, and now he has been charged with trying to overthrow the government of President Robert Mugabe. These charges are so serious that if he is found guilty, he could be sentenced to a maximum of 20 years in prison without the option of a fine.
Do we know whether he will continue to be held or whether they would release him or they may release him on bail?
Lawyers outside the court have told me that this is such a serious charge that it may have to be referred by the lower court, the Harare Magistrates Court, to the Harare High Court for him to apply for bail, and that in itself will take some days or even weeks to be processed. So he's likely to remain in police cells or to be transferred to the Harare Remand Prison by the end of today.
Protests were also called for today and tomorrow. Do we know if they have been effective?
There have been some major companies which did not open their doors for work today, but the majority of the shops and the schools, etc., are working quite normally, and the traffic is about 75% what it normally is. So this is not anything like it was last Wednesday.
Does the Reverend have any connection to any opposition parties, formally or informally? And do any opposition parties hope to capitalize from this, to gain from his popularity?
As far as we know, Evans Mawere is somebody who has a public profile in that in his private life, he is a master of ceremonies. He tries to earn money officiating at weddings and at events, none of them particularly political. We'd never really heard of him until he started sending out tweets under the banner This Flag, under the hashtag This Flag, which were, he said, a frustration that he couldn't pay school fees for his two young daughters earlier this year. There are no connections with any political party that any of us knows of, but in an urban area like Harare, which is predominantly an area which supports the opposition movement for democratic change, I'm sure he knows people from the MDC, and one of the people who became involved in the This Flag tweets, which obviously are done on a mobile phone, is a former youth leader from the MDC. But the MDC appears to be as stunned about the popularity of this message from the flag as has the government been astonished by it, and has clearly reacted in such a way that Evans Mawere is going to remain behind bars for a long time.
Is it unusual for a protest leader to appropriate nationalist symbols such as the flag? Have other protests done this before? Is this a common phenomenon to use the flag and other symbols?
No, but there hasn't been a protest like this before. And the Zimbabwe flag has become very popular recently with vendors who sell it at filling stations, who sell it on the streets. 2 years ago, you wouldn't have seen people selling the Zimbabwe flag. Now everybody is selling it everywhere.
For a few years, at least during the unity government years, coalition government, there was an uptick in the economy, but now things apparently are going backwards again into decay since the end of that unity government. Any reason why have policies changed? Is it simply bad luck and global economic conditions?
In the middle of 2013, ZANU-PF won a fantastic but disputed election victory. And in the months that followed that, a record amount of money left the country. That immediately began a decline in the economy to the state today that you cannot draw more than $100 out of your account every day. And that is going to be cut as well in the next few weeks.
That was reporter Peter Thornycroft. She spoke with VOA's William Eagle. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Solly coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. In the afterglow of America's Independence Day celebrations, host Shaka Solly and his guests will discuss what independence has meant and means for Africa. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Political conventions are a critical part of the American electoral process. Our job is to put the conventions, the candidates, and the issues into context for our listeners. Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the Republican and Democratic Party's conventions starting July 18th on VOA.
African Music Mix.
Hey, put on the move.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.